Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the 11th video of the Old Testament Survey course. In the previous sections, we looked at the prehistory portion of Genesis, and in this section, we'll look at the patriarchs. Just like we'll do with all the Old Testament books, we'll look at some background information, the organization of the book, the content of the book, and some theological themes. The patriarchs' epic is described in chapters 12 through 50 of Genesis. Therefore, let's start by reviewing where we left off the prehistory of the earlier chapters of Genesis. Remember the cycle from the prehistory? God's grace, then human sin, then punishment, then God gives grace and hope. Now, I hope you noticed these as you worked through the prehistory, but now I'd like to point out that the Tower of Babel story had sin and punishment, but there was no word of grace. Or was there? Look at the end of chapter 11. What is the next thing after the Babel story? God's word of grace is the Toledot of Shem and the Toledot of Terah, because these two genealogies both point forward to Abraham. Starting with Genesis chapter 12 is God's solution, not just for the Tower of Babel, but for all human sin and brokenness. God chose one man and his family through whom he would work to bless the entire world. This is God's final plan, which breaks the cycle of sin and punishment. It started with Abraham, climaxed in Jesus, and is still being worked out and applied in us. Therefore, Abraham, one man, has a tremendous impact on history. One man can have an earth-shattering influence when God is at work, and that means that there is no limit to what he can do through you. It started with Abraham and centered around God's promise. God's promise was to Abraham and through him to all nations. The promise was given, protected, and ultimately fulfilled, as we'll elaborate throughout the entire patriarch story. Remember this alternate way to divide history? Genesis 1 through 11 is the problem, which spirals down in depravity, and Genesis 12 through Revelation 22 is the solution. And the solution is worked out over the centuries. In other words, God's solution to humanity's problem starts with Abraham and came to completion in Jesus. Therefore, the transition between Genesis chapter 11 and 12, between the prehistory and the patriarchs, is a monumental transition, and that is where this section begins. Now, let's look a bit at some background issues, even though most of them have already been addressed in an earlier section. First is the relationship of the patriarchs to history, the historical location. We don't have any direct archaeological evidence of the patriarchs themselves, but that's not an issue. Nomadic herders don't leave cities and permanent artifacts, and we shouldn't expect to find them. However, the patriarch stories fit very well with what we know about this period and this place, and the cities and cultures with which they interacted are very well attested. This was a time of nomadic pastoral living, following flocks of animals to different pastures. It was also the time of small city-state kingdoms. And then, just a reminder of the physical location of the patriarchs. The patriarch story is a tour of the Fertile Crescent, from Mesopotamia to the Promised Land, to Egypt, and back to the Promised Land, and back to Egypt. Now, let's talk about the organization of this section by examining the outline. You may recall that the book of Genesis is divided into two epics, the prehistory and the patriarchs. We covered the prehistory in an earlier section, so now we're just looking at the patriarchs. And this epic is organized around the major stories of four generations of the patriarchs. The first generation is the story of Abraham, who is also known as Abram. Then is the story of Abraham's son Isaac. Then the story of Isaac's son Jacob, then the story of Jacob's 12 sons, concentrating on his son Joseph. But I want you to notice that during the Joseph story, there is a parallel story that highlights the conversion of his brother Judah. Now, there's a lot going on in each generation, but the overall outline is fairly simple, based around four names, with a fifth name sharing the spotlight in the last one. Now, we'll focus most of our attention on the content of the patriarchs. First are some general observations for all the generations. Keep your eye out for a few patterns that we'll see as we work through these chapters. The thread that runs through the entire story is the promise that God made. God made a promise to Abraham that has passed to his descendants. The promise is given by God, but the promise is then questioned because it is tested. The promise did not immediately come to pass, and there were many situations that made it seem like it never would. And so the patriarchs could have doubted. And throughout this section, there is a main plot, but it is surrounded by many subplots and side characters. And some of these side characters and subplots are told for contrast. That is, sometimes the characteristics or actions of characters are highlighted by similarities to or differences from the character and experiences of others. Also, pay attention to how some of the characters try to help the promise to come about. Sometimes they are helpful, but often it is counterproductive. Now, let's look specifically at Abraham's journeys. The story starts with him in the city of Ur in Mesopotamia. Then, called by God to leave his homeland and travel to the land to be given to him, he travels up Mesopotamia to Haran, where he stays for a while. And then God calls him further, and he travels through the promised land and ends up in Egypt. Then he travels back from Egypt and lives in the promised land. Abraham basically walked the entire Fertile Crescent, and later his descendants will follow his path in reverse. They will live in Egypt and then return to the promised land, and later they will be conquered by Babylon and taken back to Mesopotamia. Now let's move on to some key verses from the patriarchs. Chapter 12, verses 1 through 3 says, "The Lord had said to Abram, 'Leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you.'" This is the initial call and promise that God gave to Abraham. And this promise is the means of God's universal plan to spread his blessing to every nation, eventually fulfilled in Jesus. Next is chapter 15, verses 5 through 6. "God took Abraham outside and said, 'Look up at the heavens and count the stars, if indeed you can count them.' Then he said to him, 'So shall your offspring be.' Abram believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness." Now, there are two main ideas in these verses. The first is God's promise to make Abraham, who was childless at that time, into a great nation through his numberless descendants. And the Jewish ethnic group is the fulfillment of this promise, as ethnic Jews trace their heritage back to Abraham. And the second idea is Abraham's faith. Abraham trusted God when he made the promise, and this trust was accounted by God as righteousness. And the New Testament, especially Paul, references Abraham's trust as the pattern for those who trust in Jesus and thereby receive righteousness from Christ. The primary requirement God has for his people is for us to trust him and his word. And the last key verse is chapter 50, verse 20, in which Joseph was speaking to his brothers who had sold him into slavery. He said, "You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." This highlights that God was always protecting and working out his promise, even when circumstances and human agents seemed to work against it. God was in complete control of every situation and was actually using them to bring about what he had planned all along. These are a few of the main ideas from the story of the patriarchs. Now, let's look in more detail at some of the sections. As I mentioned earlier, it starts at the beginning of chapter 12 with God calling Abraham and giving him tremendous promises. We were introduced to Abram, as he was first known, as the climax of the genealogies in chapter 11. And now he becomes the focus of the story. But why Abram? Why this one man out of all the many people at the time? I don't know. It was God's choice. Not because Abram was righteous, because Abram was a pagan until God called him. But God chose one man for a special mission to bless the world. And God called him and gave him promises of blessing. And it was a promise of scrub, the first beginning of God's rescue operation for humanity. The promise comes in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, which we've already seen. But let's break down those verses into the specific ideas that God spoke to Abraham. First, God commanded Abram to leave his home and people to travel to a place that God would show him. He did not give him the details at that time, but just said, "Start walking, and I'll lead you." Then he said, "I will make you into a great nation." God promised to make a nation out of the descendants of a man who had no children at that time. Then God promised, "I will bless you." God will do good to Abraham in ways that he has not yet defined. He said, "I will make your name great." Contrast this with back in chapter 11, verse 4, where the people of Babel wanted to make their name great by building a tower to heaven. How did that work out? Is their name famous? Do you know the name of any of those people? But have you ever heard of Abraham? Of course, he's a major character of the Bible. What they tried to get by rebellion, they didn't get, but Abraham received it by trusting and obeying God. Then God told Abram, "You will be a blessing." God's promise of blessing was not just for Abram, not for selfish purposes. And the same is true for us. God's blessing for us is not just for us, but they are for the people around us. God blesses us to bless others through us. God said, "I will bless those that bless you, and I will curse those who curse you." God's work through Abram divides humanity. There is no neutral ground. Everyone is either on board with what God is doing, or they are resistant to it. And finally, God said, "Every tribe of the earth will be blessed through you." Remember that God's intention is universal blessing to every people group of the world. And we see the result of this in Revelation chapter 7, where a numberless multitude from every nation, tribe, people, and language is worshiping around God's throne. But it all starts with one man. God's universal intention works through historical particularity. God plays favorites to bring about his purposes. And we cannot complain that God did not start with Canada or China or Chile or Cameroon. He is God, and he started with Abraham. But the end of his plan is blessings to all nations. Now, I hope you see that much of this promise is like the promise of scrub that we talked about in an earlier section. And I hope you're starting to process how God's dealing with Abraham relates to our discussion of scrub, because these ideas are very important for understanding the Old Testament and the Christian life in general. And for this reason, I have created a supplementary video to explore in more depth how the promise of Abraham relates to scrub throughout the Bible, and also to explore how the elements of scrub relate to one another. In other words, how does salvation relate to blessing? How does community interact with relationship, etc.? And I recommend that you check out this video because it will help you better understand how the biblical big picture fits together. And because we won't have time to explore these important issues here in this section. Instead, we'll continue with the story of Abraham in Genesis. In the first three verses of chapter 12, as we've seen, God gives the promise. In the rest of the patriarch story, the promise is tested, confirmed, and eventually fulfilled. The rest of chapter 12 tells how Abram traveled to the promised land and then to Egypt, where God protected him and his family, even though Abram did not behave very well. Then in chapter 13, Abram is contrasted with his nephew Lot. They go their separate ways, Lot choosing what he thought was the better destiny. But the promise and the blessing went with Abram. And this is confirmed in verses 15 through 17, where God promises all of the land to Abram. And he expands the promise by stating that Abraham will have offspring as many as the dust of the earth. And in chapter 14, Abraham walks in the promise and blessing. He helps the kings of the land and rescues Lot, and he is blessed by Melchizedek, king of Salem, and priest of God Most High. And this chapter ends with an important demonstration of Abraham's character. He is offered the riches from the military conquest, but he turns them down. And the reason he gives is so that no one will be able to say, "I made Abram rich." He knows that he'll be rich because God has promised, and he ensures that God gets all the credit. Then chapter 15 is a very important chapter, because in this chapter, God renews the promise, Abram demonstrates his trust, and God initiates the covenant with Abraham. This chapter begins with God renewing and elaborating on his promise to Abram. He said, "Do not be afraid. I am your shield, your very great reward." Notice that Abram had just turned down the offer of riches from the kings, and God says that he himself is Abram's reward. Talk about holding out for a better deal. Abraham gave up riches from kings, but received God as his protector and friend. And he also got material riches thrown in. Then Abram brought up his childless state. God's blessing would end with his death. And God responded by assuring him that a child from his own body would be his heir. Not only that, but he took him outside, drew his attention to the stars in the sky, and promised that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars. And Abram believed the Lord, and it was credited to him as righteousness. Genesis 15:6 is one of the most important verses in the Bible, and it's quoted in the New Testament. It was not the quality or strength of Abraham's faith, but it was the object of his faith that mattered. He trusted God, and God graciously considered him to be on the right side. And God responded in verse 7 with a very important phrase. He said, "I am Yahweh." He reminded Abram that he took him out of his hometown Ur, and he reiterated that he is giving him the promised land as his possession. And then Abram asked God how he could know that he will possess the land. God responded by commanding a ritual, which may seem strange to us, but totally makes sense in their culture. He made Abram cut animals in half and arrange them in two rows. So, what is going on with that? Well, that was part of a covenant ceremony. Remember that we've defined a covenant as a solemn commitment to a person, similar to a marriage. And just like in a modern marriage, in those days, there were rituals and ceremonies to enter a covenant relationship. In this particular ceremony, the slaughtered animals would be arranged in two rows, and the two covenant parties would walk together down this row of death. The symbolism was saying that the two parties were swearing that they would become like the animals if they ever broke the covenant. They were saying, "May this happen to me if I'm unfaithful." It was a very graphic way to swear an oath of covenant loyalty. So Abram asked how he could know, and God set up an oath ceremony. God told Abram in detail what would happen to his descendants and reiterated his promise that they would inherit the land. And then God's presence, symbolized by a burning torch, walked down the line. And he did it alone. Instead of the two parties walking together as was usual. In other words, in response to Abram's question, God unilaterally promised on oath to do all that he had said with a typical covenant formula. And in verse 18, it says that the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Then in chapter 16, Abram tried to help the promise. Abram was childless because his wife was barren. Therefore, he and his wife conspired that he would have a child with their female slave named Hagar. And so Hagar became pregnant and gave birth to Abram's first son, who was named Ishmael. In chapter 17, God repeated his promise and confirmed his covenant with Abram. When Abram was 99 years old and his wife was 90, God appeared to him again. He said, "I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless. I will confirm my covenant between me and you and will greatly increase your numbers." Then God changed Abram's name to Abraham. Abram means exalted father, and Abraham means father of many. And he changed his wife's name to Sarah, which means princess. And God elaborated and confirmed the terms of his covenant. First, he specified that the covenant was not just for Abraham, but also for his descendants. Next, he required Abraham and all the males in his family to be circumcised as a sign of the covenant. And God specified that Sarah would have a son, and her descendants would be kings. Now, Abraham doubted and laughed because he and his wife were very old. Abraham suggested that God should make his covenant with his son Ishmael, but God insisted that the covenant and blessing will be with Sarah's son and not with Hagar's son Ishmael. God doesn't need Abraham's help to fulfill the promise. God chose to make the covenant with only one of Abraham's sons, through Sarah. Now, God was good to Ishmael, but chose Isaac to fulfill his plan in contrast to Ishmael. And in chapter 18, God repeated his promise and makes himself known to Abraham. He tells them that they will have a son within a year. And he does not hide from Abraham what he was doing, that he was about to destroy Sodom. But he made himself known to Abraham and allowed Abraham to question his actions and inquire about his character. Abraham said, "Won't the judge of all the earth do right?" Abraham asked if God will destroy Sodom if there was 50 righteous people, and God said no. That demonstrates God's just and merciful character. And then Abraham bargained down to 40, 30, 20, and finally 10 righteous people. And each time, God agreed. And notice that God did not stop saying yes to a lower number until Abraham stopped asking. We have not yet found the end of God's mercy. And yet, his mercy was exercised while also upholding his righteous justice. In chapter 19, God destroyed the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah for their extraordinary wickedness. But in his mercy, he rescued Abraham's nephew Lot and his family, from whom came the Moabites and the Ammonites. All three of the innocent people were spared, just like Abraham was asking. And these episodes contrast Sodom, Lot, Moab, Ammon as people who are not the focus of God's blessing, promise, and covenant. In chapter 20, Abraham wavered in his faith, and yet God still protected him and the promise. And God even caused him to prosper materially. In chapter 21, the promise is partly fulfilled by the birth of Isaac. And Isaac is contrasted with Ishmael, who is sent away from Abraham's family, because God insisted that the blessing will be fulfilled through Isaac, the child of promise. And Abraham prospers more and more. And then in chapter 22, the promise is tested. There are many parallels in this chapter with the initial promise in chapter 12. In this chapter, God asked Abraham to kill his son Isaac as a sacrifice. And do you see the problem for the story here? If Isaac dies, what happens to the promise and the blessing? Now, don't worry. God knew what he was going to do all along, but he wanted to reveal himself to Abraham through this lesson. And Abraham responded with trust. And the punchline of this story is that God will provide. God is the one who brings about his promises with, without, and even in spite of our help. Any promise we could do on our own is not worth it. God provides the sacrifice in this episode, and he alone is glorified. God's promise comes about by grace, through faith, not because of our works. And in this chapter, God renewed his promise to Abraham and his descendants. And that brings us to the story of Isaac. And Isaac is actually a minor player in Genesis. He's contrasted with Ishmael, who gets a Toledot formula and genealogy later in chapter 25. In chapter 24, Abraham sends to search for a wife for Isaac, and prayer plays a key part in that story as the ideal for finding God's blessing and direction. God leads and provides, and Rebekah marries Isaac to carry on the promise to their descendants. And in chapters 25 and 26, the promise is confirmed to Isaac, and Isaac walks in the ways of Abraham. In chapter 26, verses 23 through 25, the Lord appeared to Isaac and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not be afraid, for I am with you. I will bless you and will increase the number of your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." Isaac built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord. There he pitched his tent. Do you hear the echoes of the promise that God gave to Abraham, that they're now being given to his son and the descendants after? And then this section ends with the death of Abraham. Next is the story of Jacob. It starts with the Toledot formula in 25:19, and Jacob is contrasted with his twin brother Esau. The promise is through Jacob, not Esau. This, again, is based on God's choice, not the natural birthright order, because Esau was born first. And it's not because of what they did, because God announced this choice before they were born. And Jacob lacks character. He is a trickster. Jacob tries to get the promise by his own strength and guile. He conned the birthright from his brother in chapter 25, and he stole his father's blessing by guile in chapter 27, and because of his underhanded ways, he ends up fleeing the country from his brother who wants to kill him. Then, just before he crosses the border out of the promised land back to Mesopotamia, Jacob had a dream and received the renewed promise from God. And this is the beginning of Jacob's conversion. God renews his promise to Jacob. Starting in Genesis 28:13, it says, "There above the ladder to heaven stood the Lord, and he said, 'I am Yahweh, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. I will give you and your descendants the land on which you are lying. Your descendants will be like the dust of the earth, and you will spread out to the west and to the east, to the north and to the south. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you and your offspring. I am with you and will watch over you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Again, do you hear the echoes of the same promise that God gave to Abraham in the promise to his grandson Jacob? Then once in Mesopotamia, Jacob meets Abraham's relative Laban and Laban's daughters Rachel and Leah. Jacob loves Rachel and works 7 years for her. But the trickster is tricked. He gets deceived in the same way he deceived and ends up with Leah, the ugly sister, instead of Rachel. And so he works another 7 years for Rachel. And Jacob eventually had 12 sons, a large family. His 12 sons will father what will later be the 12 tribes of the nation of Israel from their respective descendants. The promise is being fulfilled. Not yet as many as the stars of the sky, but 12 sons is a good start. And Jacob starts to prosper materially, helping the promise, and yet God still blesses him. Then after 2 decades, Jacob returns back to the promised land. And God protects the promise by protecting Jacob from Laban, who wants to harm him. And on the border of the promised land, Jacob wrestled with God and is brought to the end of his own resources and finally submits to God. And here is where God changed Jacob's name to Israel. And this seems to be the point of Jacob's conversion. Then he meets with his brother Esau, who had wanted to kill him, and they have an uneasy reconciliation. But at the end of the meeting, Jacob lies to Esau and goes his own way. The deceiver is still deceiving. So we're left with a bit of a question on Jacob. Has he really converted? And his sons are mixed character, not always virtuous. And then this section ends with a Toledot and genealogy of Esau by way of contrast with Jacob. Jacob is far from perfect, but he's walking in God's promise and blessing because God is perfect. Then finally is the story of Joseph, one of Jacob's 12 sons. And remember that intertwined with the Joseph story, there is the subplot of Judah's conversion. And this starts with another Toledot formula in 37:2, and then continues the legacy of Jacob's dysfunctional family. Now, you can't make this stuff up. It plays like a soap opera in some respects, but it is true. Jacob the deceiver is deceived by his sons and loses his favorite son. Jacob's deceitful ways are bearing fruit, and the promise is tested. Will the promise fail? Well, we'll see. In this section, Joseph is contrasted with his 11 brothers. And it starts with Joseph having a dream from God that he would rule over his brothers. Again, this is out of the normal birth order. Joseph is one of the youngest, but he is his father's favorite, and he's faithful to his father. But Joseph's dream is questioned by circumstances. He's kidnapped by his brothers. He is sold into slavery in Egypt. He is unjustly accused and thrown into jail. And yet, God is with him, because this is all part of God's larger plan. Joseph remains faithful, and he providentially rises to power in every circumstance. He's put in charge of his master's house. He's given a position of responsibility in the jail. And finally, he is miraculously placed as ruler over all Egypt. Psalm 105 recounts this episode, starting at verse 17, when it says in part, God sent a man before them, Joseph, who was sold as a slave. His feet were hurt with fetters. His neck was put in a collar of iron until what he had said came to pass. The word of the Lord tested him. But the NIV translates the last verse, till what he foretold came to pass, till the word of the Lord proved him true. Now, both of these translations are good and accurate. And as we've seen, the promise is tested and the promise is proved true after being tested, by being tested. Joseph is tested and Joseph is vindicated by the word of the Lord. And then while ruling Egypt, by God's intervention, Joseph prevented a famine and saved all of Egypt and the surrounding countries. And because of this, his brothers came to him to get food, but they didn't recognize that he is their lost brother. And he tested his brothers to see if they would still betray their other younger brother and grieve their father again. And in that larger episode, notice that Judah is the one who stands up for his younger brother, Benjamin, at great cost to himself. Judah has converted. And finally, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, and they are reconciled. And they bring Jacob and all his family down to Egypt, where they live in privilege because of Joseph's status. After a while, Jacob is near to death, and he blesses his sons. And Judah and Joseph's two sons stand out as the primary recipients of Jacob's blessing. Although it is made clear that all 12 sons will share in God's promise and be God's people, and the hope that they will all return to the promised land is highlighted. Then Jacob dies, and they bury him in the promised land. And Joseph is fully reconciled to his brothers. He assures them that their misdeeds toward him, even though they were truly wicked, were somehow part of God's working out his providence to save people and protect the promise. And then Genesis ends with the death of Joseph and the hope of them all eventually returning to the promised land. Now, there's a lot that happened in the patriarch epic, and we had to skip a lot of stuff, but God has protected his promise and his people, and they are a growing family dwelling in Egypt, which sets the scene for the Exodus in the next Old Testament book. So now, let's look at a few theological themes that we've seen in this section. The first is the promise. The promise is graciously given by God to Abraham and his descendants. But the promise is tested. It's not easy or automatic. And sometimes it looks like it will fail, yet it never does. And the promise is fulfilled gradually. At the end of Genesis, some parts of the promise are fulfilled. Abraham has a son who grows into a large family, but some parts are not yet fulfilled. They are not yet a great nation, and they do not yet possess the promised land. And the promise is fulfilled sometimes with Abraham's help, sometimes without, and sometimes in spite of his attempts to bring along the promise. Then the second theme is election. God chose some to be the focus and recipients of his promise. And this is by God's choice, and not because of extra value or merit in the one chosen. And they were chosen for blessing, and to be a blessing to others through them. They were chosen for God's purposes, not for selfish benefit. And then the final theme is covenant. As we've seen, a covenant is a solemn commitment to a person. And in the patriarch story, the covenant is always initiated and secured by God himself. The covenant with Abraham is unilateral blessing from God. But the covenant requires holiness and obedience from God's people. These are the major theological themes of the patriarch section of Genesis. And so now, let's review the four sections of the Genesis patriarchs, which correspond to the four generations of the patriarchs. They are Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, which is also about Judah. And let's review the three theological themes of the patriarchs. They are promise, election, and covenant. And that wraps up the patriarch section and the book of Genesis. Remember that there is a supplemental section to elaborate on God's promised blessing and the working out of scrub. And in the section after that, we will start on the next epic and the next biblical book of the Exodus. I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you are as well. Thanks for watching.